Now, with over 25 years of experience integrating mental health and spirituality, the author of Reclaiming Authenticity, When Ancestors Weep, and Redeeming the Bereaved, here is Dr. James Houck.
Well, good afternoon, everyone, wherever you are in the world at this time, whenever you are in the world at this time, welcome to Reclaiming Authenticity, finding one's courage to reclaim that which has always been in you. Very happy to be with you here today and every Friday at 3 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, noon Pacific Standard Time. I am Dr. James Houck, and if you'd like more information about me or leave me your comments about today's show, I invite you to visit the website. That address is www.bbsradio.com/reclaiming authenticity. www.bbsradio.com/reclaiming authenticity. And if you would like to be part of this show, you can invite you to call in. The number is 888-627-6008. That's 888-627-6008. And I'm also happy to report that these broadcasts are podcasted in case you want to go back and listen again, or you can go back into the archives and listen to previous shows. So if you are a new listener, I just welcome aboard. I wanted to let you know that each and every week, these broadcasts focus on the integration of spirituality and our mental health, and all placed within the context of our relationships, the relationships that we have with ourselves, relationships that we have with others, and the relationship that we have with God or the divine. And I would like to say that I'm a strong believer that all of us come into the world already equipped and graced with everything we need for this life in terms of giftedness or skills or talents and strengths and character traits and so forth. However, there just might be times throughout our lives in which we may feel that we need to hide our giftedness, our uniqueness, or we push our giftedness way, way down inside of us so that others cannot see it. It's almost as if we want to, protect that from others, you know, that we feel will take advantage of that or exploit that. Or, you know, perhaps as we were growing up, we were told that we would never amount to anything, or whatever other voice we heard telling us that there's nothing special to us, which we come to find out later they've been nothing more than lies. But at any rate, the damage could already be done if we don't recognize the lies, because we don't realize that our giftedness and the uniqueness that we have, and we go through life kind of functioning from a place of woundedness or victimhood instead of a place of healing, or instead of a place of wholeness and embracing our uniqueness, our hachetas. In fact, there is so much more to us than what we have become so far, so much more than perhaps we have even realized up until this moment. And this is what Reclaiming Authenticity is all about, finding your courage to reclaim that which has always been in you. So, let 2021 be the year you reclaim more of your authentic voice and more of your authentic self. Well, how is your heart today? I hope it is well, and I hope that you are well. I hope that if you are even struggling, even in the slightest way today, you will be able to find rest and comfort and the peace that you need. Well, let me be the first to say to you, Happy New Year. Welcome to 2021. We made it, okay? The 2020 year is behind us, and we're going to talk about stories today a little bit, and just the power of narrative and how we tell stories, or where inside of us do those stories come from. And if you're like me, you know, we need to go back in 2020, and there's a lot we can reflect on, or there's a lot that, you know, a lot of stories that we can tell, that's for sure. But anyway, nonetheless, welcome to 2021. I hope that you're off to a very, very good start, and that momentum just continues throughout this year. Excuse me. Well, we've just come off another holiday season, and you and I both know that wherever and whenever there are holidays, there are often family gatherings. And I know, you know, in 2020, it was a bit limited and or modified is probably a better word to say. And we also know that, you know, where there are holidays and there often are family gatherings, there's often a lot of food. And when families get together to celebrate the holidays with food, what do we have? Okay, no, it's not the perfect storm, okay? I don't care who burned what or who spilled what. But rather, when we come together and we celebrate the holidays and it's always surrounding a lot of food, we have the opportunity to tell stories. You know, the family stories, the ones that you hear year after year after year. And perhaps you've heard me say this before, that perhaps you were a young child or a small child, or even before you became a teenager yourself, that you knew these family stories by heart. In fact, you would sit there at the table or somewhere else as, you know, the chosen person is the one telling the story that year, and you're just kind of mouthing along with them, you know, just in the right cadence and maybe even the right expressions or the right tone or emotions that these stories are told. And it's very noteworthy that, you know, if these stories are told in the same way year after year after year, nothing's really going to change. Okay. And it's, you know, if 2020 has taught us anything, it's impossible to change the past. However, we can change how we take a look at the past, or how we understand the past, or even how we tell stories from the past. You see, we can tell these familiar stories the same way year after year, and nothing really changes. But what happens if we start to find that healing, grace, and peace, and unconditional love, everything that our heart's been crying out for? Let's say we begin to find that, and we start to understand where these stories are coming from, or why they're told a certain way, but we start to begin to tell them differently. You know, we're going to keep the, you know, the facts and figures and all that stuff. That's always going to be there. But how we tell that story, or even with what kind of emotion, or perhaps we could even modify the story, because now we're telling that story from a place of wholeness and peace and comfort and healing, instead of that usual place of family woundedness. Okay, so I'm sure there are many stories told even during the days of COVID and holiday season of COVID and so forth. But all of us do have family stories to tell. And here we are on New Year's Day 2021. So let's just start off with a nice question. You know, what's your New Year's traditions? What are your New Year's stories? On my father's side, I came to appreciate the stories and, of course, the food for more of the German, Polish, Hungarian perspective. And, of course, since it's New Year's Day, you know, coming from that kind of a background of German, Polish, and Hungarian, you have to eat pork and sauerkraut with mashed potatoes. Anybody else? Anybody else eat that from New Year's Day? I mean, that's just a given, you know. And one of the messages that I heard growing up was, you don't want to tempt fate. You don't want to start off the year with a lot of bad luck, you know, because you have to have pork and sauerkraut, you know, and you have to have lots of mashed potatoes, where you can put the sauerkraut in the well of the mashed potatoes with lots of juice, because, well, after all, that's where the luck is. Well, yeah, okay, it's a story, All right. But you better believe I'm eating pork and sauerkraut on New Year's Day, whether or not it's true. I'm just like, okay, I'm not going to flirt with any kind of like, well, what if it is? Okay. So, yeah, you can also eat, you know, stuffed cabbage or pierogies on New Year's, but you have to have a generous helping of pork and sauerkraut with the mashed potatoes. Okay. Hot dogs and sauerkraut is not going to cut it. That doesn't qualify. Okay. So you have to pork roast or something like that. Pork chops. Yeah. Okay. That'll get you by and everything. But usually, you know, it's a pork roast and sauerkraut, which I have mine in the crock pot. And so after this broadcast today, you better believe I'm going to sit down and have a little sampling of it just to make sure it's processing nicely, coming along nicely. Okay. But yeah, it's not just New Year's Day that I eat pork and sauerkraut. I'll eat it other times during the year. After all, like I said, I come from that German, Polish, Hungarian background. But I don't know if you were like me and you just heard the stories over and over again of like the New Year's Day traditions. Okay. But do you ever wonder why people eat pork and sauerkraut on New Year's Day? Well, it's because you want to start off the new year with as much luck as you can get. And the reason why it's pork and not beef or fish, okay, is because if you've ever been around pigs and you just watch them in their slop and wherever else they're roaming around, pigs root forward with their hooves. And therefore, you want to look forward, not backwards. See, a cow or a steer or, you know, another animal will root backwards. They'll move their legs backwards as if they're digging. Well, pigs do that forward. You know, they don't go backwards at all. So that's where the tradition came from about eating pork and sauerkraut on New Year's Day, because the pig roots forward. And therefore, you want to look forward with as much luck as you can get, but not backwards. Well, I took the liberty this week, just curious, because, you know, I'm a lover of food and traditions, and when you start to combine the two, you get some interesting combinations. And what I found was that some people in the South actually eat a cold black-eyed peas salad. Okay, and I've had that before. It's actually pretty good, very tasty, very chewy. But others in the deep South might enjoy making and eating king cake. Okay. Usually, you know, people want to associate this with Mardi Gras. It's coming up. Okay. We're still several weeks away. But on New Year's Day, a lot of people eat king cake. And you have to be careful when you get your slice of king cake, because the baker will put a little figurine of the baby Jesus in there, a little plastic, you know, figurine just to celebrate the birth of Christ. Or actually, it should be that the celebration of the wise men or the magi coming to the baby Jesus. And so that's where it gets its name, king cake. Or some bakers have been known to put in a ring. So you got to be careful in those first couple of bites that you don't break a filling. But it is a delicious cake altogether. Other parts of the world, in China and Japan and other Asian countries, it's customary to eat noodles on New Year's Day. And the longer the noodle, the better, because the length of the noodle symbolizes longevity. Okay, so it's definitely very appropriate to slurp your noodles if you're having Chinese or Japanese or another dish from an Asian country that is serving noodles on New Year's Day. Well, in Scandinavian countries, eating herring is considered a sign of good fortune for the whole year. And I don't really have all the time to go through all the countries and the customs and so forth, but they are fun nonetheless, because as humanity and cultures and languages and norms and so forth, we often come up with our own traditions. And this is why we do what we do. Such as this is why we do what we do on, let's say, New Year's. Okay, so for the sake of argument, you know, before we root forward into 2021, let's take a moment and just reflect just briefly on 2020. Okay, and let's just kind of kick around some questions. you know, like such as what lessons have we learned, you know, over the past year? What insights have we gained? Have we gained insights? Hopefully we have, but what insights have we gained? Okay, let's take it a little bit deeper here. And what are some things that you had to let go of in 2020? And what are some things that you want to take hold of this year? Okay, just a few questions to kick around. What lessons have we learned this past year? What insights have we gained? What are some things that we had to let go of? And what are some things where we want to take hold of this year? Hopefully, letting go of things that no longer serve us and taking hold of things that speak that life into us. Okay. Well, the interesting thing about reflecting on these questions is that they are often better understood, and in fact, they're often better remembered within the context of stories. Okay, so let's just throw in yet another question. What is your all-time favorite story? You know, we all have one. We all have at least one, if not three or four or five. But what is your all-time favorite story? You know, the one that you can sit and listen to, or perhaps it's the story that you know so familiar, you tell over and over and over again. As I said, we all have our favorites. Okay, so what is your all-time favorite story to read or to listen to or to tell? And, you know, if you're like me, you know, you look back in elementary school when we first learned how to, let's say, write a story, or maybe it was the middle school or high school, you know, and we needed all the, you know, like the five things that are needed to tell a good story or to report a story. You know, what, when, where, why, and how? Or who was it or who is it? Who is that person in your family who assumes the role of the storyteller? In my family, it's me. Okay. My wife always says that I don't really tell stories, but I mix in a little, shall we say, BS from time to time. But I just tell her, well, I just kind of flesh it out. So we both remember, when our kids were smaller and getting them ready for bed and everything. And instead of reading them a story, I would often tell them a story, which they're minds would connect to, and they would get all wound up and wouldn't be able to go to sleep afterwards, you know, right after like the end. Okay, time to go to sleep. And they wouldn't, because they would just be so keyed up. And then for some reason, I would get into trouble. Okay, because apparently it was time for them to go to sleep. But I told too many lively stories that just got them going. But that's the way I just tell a story. You know, you have to get into it. You have to get caught up into it as well. So whenever you listen to or read a story or whatever your favorite story is, what captures your attention? What captures your attention? You know, maybe it's the mental images that have formed in your mind. You know, as you sit back and you listen to a story being told or read to you, you close your eyes and you can see in your mind's eye these images of the characters in the story or what's going on in the story. Perhaps what else captures your attention are the deeper lessons or morals found in the storyline itself. Okay. You know, some stories, you know, the morals or the lessons are just obvious. They're right there, you know, like perhaps friendship or, you know, another kind of relationship that has this deep, deep value. And then there's some stories that are just a little bit more difficult to find the lessons or the morals. Okay. They're a little bit more hidden. They're not as transparent. All right. But they're there. Or perhaps what captures our attention is the way in which the story was told that created this excitement or this enthusiasm. You know, and perhaps it's this last point that why the Audible app is so popular. I mean, who would have thought? Yeah, you could read books, you know, on an iPad or whatever, just through the Kindle app. But when Audible came around, it's like, oh, great, we can just download books and we could pop in some earbuds or earphones and listen to the story. And some recordings are a little bit more animated than others. Some it's just a person reading from the book itself. But this has just become so popular, not only just the past year, but several years back. And, you know, it's also very nice that we can download the stories and just replay them at will. Or, you know, we may even be able to, you know, just take out with us and listen to a story being read to us in the car or on trips or wherever. It's just really, you know, a matter of convenience. And it's something fascinating about hearing a story being read to us. And this is the whole premise behind the movie The Reader. Now, I don't know if you've ever, you know, there's a book out called The Reader. It's also in German. But then later the movie came out. And like I said, I don't know if you've ever read the movie. I highly recommend, or read the story or watched the movie. But I do highly recommend it because The Reader, the context is set in post-World War II Germany as the country attempts to rebuild itself. And this is where a teenager by the name of Michael Berg meets Hannah Schmitz. She's a bus conductor and a much older woman. And as things unfold quickly, their relationship is passionate, to say the least. But what makes their relationship memorable is that she would often ask Michael to read to her. And he had no idea that she couldn't read. He just thought that this was something that she'd love to do. And of course, he obliged her and was like, hey, I brought another book today, and so I'll read you, you know, some chapters or whatever. And this goes on for some time, and it's quite moving. You can just see Hannah Schmitz, you know, that character in the movie anyway, just her expressions as she's sitting and listening to these stories and the mental images that are unfolding. Okay. Unfortunately, when Hannah abruptly moves away one day without informing Michael, he's left confused and he's heartbroken. But years later, when he was studying law at Heidelberg University, the teacher took the class on a field trip and actually took them to part of a trial that was undergoing for Nazi war crimes. And, you know, Michael is sitting up in the balcony with his classmates, and he's just appalled to discover that there's Hannah. She's on trial for committing a heinous war crime. And like I said, if you haven't seen the movie or read the book, I won't give away the ending, but I invite you to enjoy this story. Just a lot of powerful, powerful themes that are going on. Well, back in April of 2020, I don't know if you've read this article or not, but NPR did a story that was entitled How Stories Connect and Persuade Us, Unleashing the Brain Power of Narrative. Okay, How Stories Connect and Persuade Us, Unleashing the Brain Power of Narrative. Now, according to the article, with the benefit of MRI scans, many different areas of the brain just lit up when, you know, in the research, they found that when people listen to a story or a narrative. And it wasn't just the areas of the brain that are responsible for, shall we say, like language processing, but other neurological circuits also lit up as the story was being told. And for instance, during, you know, the more emotional sections of the story, one study found that the neurons responsible for processing emotions that came from the sounds were activated. So as you hear a story unfold, your brain waves actually start to synchronize with those of the storyteller. Okay? And I thought this was just very fascinating. Okay? Because we're listening to the sounds and the emotions, and we're connecting up with how stories are being told to us. Okay? And one professor of psychology at Princeton University, Dr. Yuri Hassan, found that as one person told a story and the other person listened to the story, They found that the greater the listener's comprehension, the more closely the brainwave patterns mirrored those of the storyteller. So in other words, stories stick with us often because of the metaphors that people use to tell the story, or how the story is told, or the emotions of, you know, from which a story is shared. And so it's not just the reader, it's not just the storytellers, but it's also the one who's listening to these stories. You know, the brainwaves are almost matching. So storytelling also helps with our learning as we're, you know, getting older, or as we're coming up in, let's say, grammar school or middle school, because stories are easy to remember. Okay. Peg Neuhauser, she's an organizational psychologist. She found that learning, which stems from a well-told story, her words, is remembered more accurately and for a lot longer than learning simply from just, you know, derived from facts and figures. She said you put a story to the learning and people will remember. But it was Jerome Bruner, another psychologist, he'd also did research in this area, and he suggested that facts are 20 times more likely to be remembered if they're part of a story. Okay, and I can attest to this because I can remember the stories my history teacher told us back in eighth grade. You know, whether he was talking about the Revolutionary War or the Civil War, he would always place us in the story lines. We felt as if we were right there, and it just made learning fun. And, you know, I'm not bragging here, but I did get an A in the entire class for the eighth grade. So I am a lover of history for that very reason. And so highly recommend, if you've never considered yourself a storyteller, to give it a shot. Listen to yourself. Tape yourself telling a story. And just listen to your highs and lows and, you know, the rhythm and the cadence of how you tell a story and what's being heard. You know, how is your voice coming across and so forth. So let's bring all this into the world of mental health. Okay. Storytelling is a very powerful means also of helping people find the healing and the peace they are so desperately searching for, because it places their experiences within a greater context. It's how people find meaning and make sense out of what they have been through, or, you know, what they are going through presently. And when you think about it, everyone I counsel has a story to tell. It's part of it. You know, just I usually start off with just tell me something about yourself, or bring me up to speed as to what's been going on in the past couple of months, or what's been going on since last week. Okay? And here come the stories, because the stories provide the greater context from which the experiences occur. Okay. Everyone I counsel has a story to tell. In fact, every person's life is also a story worth telling. And every story worth telling is a story worth listening to. And you're probably like me. I have listened to many stories that have been told in sadness and pain. And I've listened to the metaphors and the words that people would choose. And there's this underlying just sense of hurt. I've also listened to stories that were told in heartbreak and anger, frustration, even rage. And I've also listened to many stories that were told in the emotions of joy and hope and peace and contentment. Okay. And one of the more interesting aspects I've found is that when people tell their story from, let's say, a place of anger, they typically forget all the other good things that have occurred in their life. Okay? You know what I mean by that? It's almost as if anger produces a kind of amnesia, or at least a selective amnesia. You know, all the good and wonderful experiences have been forgotten, as if past emotional, psychological, or, you know, physical and spiritual woundedness is all that can be remembered in the heat of the moment. You see, when we get used to telling a story a certain way, we do tend to forget all the other things that came before. You know, it's almost as if it's conveniently erased for the time being. But as we tell these same stories from a healthier place in us, this also allows others connect to the healthier places within themselves. Okay, just remember the brain patterns. Sooner or later, they're going to sync up from the storyteller to the story listener. But what allows us to make this shift? How do we go from telling a story from a place of woundedness to then telling the same story, but from a healthier whole place in us? Well, author Marianne Williamson states that we could actually tell how much we have been healed or how we are healing from our past because we have forgotten the pain in the memory. Okay, and this is kind of ironic, okay, when you think about it. As we tell stories from a place of wholeness, we forget the pain in the memory. Okay, and we forget the pain when these stories are told from a place of wholeness. Yet, when we tell our stories from a place of anger, we tend to forget all the good. It's very ironic. It's also, you know, just kind of upside down or kind of, this doesn't make sense, but it's true. Just listen to the next time that you hear a story told in anger, and, you know, it just, like in the heat of an argument, you tend to forget, you know, all the good stuff, and you're so focused either, you know, from that wounded place in you, and let's say it's a wounded ego, or, you know, you felt like you've been taken advantage of, or you're not being heard, or whatever it is. And yet you, in the heat of the moment, like I said, you tend to forget all the times that you have been heard, all the times that, you know, that you've been happy, that you've been treated well and so forth. But just, you know, like I said, the irony is there where we tell stories from anger, we forget all the good things. But when we tell those stories from a place of wholeness, we forget the pain in the memory of that story, because we're telling it now from a much healthier place in us. Because you see, everybody has their authentic voice, and where there's a voice, there is sound. And of course, where there is sound, there is vibration. And this is where healing occurs. We change the voice. We change the way, you know, we tell a story, and therefore we're changing the vibration, and ultimately we change the energy that's going on. And this is what creates just a wonderful, wonderful shift in us. Well, as a counseling educator and clinician and pastoral professional, I'm often saddened by people's beliefs that when it comes to sharing their stories about their physical or emotional or psychological, spiritual problems, they consider themselves powerless and without a voice. And perhaps this is a result of never feeling valued or never being allowed or encouraged to use their voice. Okay, but this is where we find our strength, because the human voice has power, because it carries with it the energy of its vibration. And perhaps this is one reason why people who deny truth just have no tolerance for those who mention the truth, or at least present the truth from a different perspective. Okay. Well, I am certainly glad that you have tuned in here with me today, and I would really love to hear your heart on how you have found your own healing through storytelling. So again, if you would like to call in, that number is 888-627-6008, that 888-627-6008, and I'll be taking your calls after the break. Again, you are listening to Reclaiming Authenticity, and I'm your host, Dr. James Happ. I'll be back with you in 1 minute. Oh, welcome back. Happy New Year's, one and all. It's 2021. Yes, we have made it. We got through 2020. Maybe by the skin of our teeth, but we got through it nonetheless. So happy New Year to one and all. I'm Dr. James Houken, and you're listening to Reclaiming Authenticity. And I just want to share a word with you about next week's show. I've entitled it The Six Ways of Being Religious. And we're going to be taking a look at how people live out their mental health and spirituality in terms of, let's say, their religious observances or their traditions or their beliefs and so forth. So tune in next Friday afternoon, noon Pacific Standard Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Well, earlier in the broadcast, we have been talking about a different way to look at how we might find healing when another person wounds us emotionally or psychologically or physically or spiritually through storytelling, through sharing our narrative. Okay. Now, admittedly, many people are unable to perceive their insights and their strengths as if they cannot see themselves capable of healing, let alone achieving anything meaningful with their lives. And, you know, a lot of people just get into this rut of telling and retelling and retelling the same story of their lives. Perhaps there was a turning point, or perhaps if they're looking back on their lives, they'll say, you know, if it wasn't for that, I could have, I should have, I would have. And it's the same narrative. Nothing changes because they have not healed. Nothing has shifted in them because they have not healed. They tell the same story with the same enthusiasm or the same emotions because nothing has healed. And most of the time, people are content to live for brief moments of joy and celebration that are kind of marked off or set aside by transitional milestones of, let's say, family baptisms or marriages, celebration of birthdays, graduations, promotions, retirements, whatever. Okay, but when it comes to wrestling with life questions, many people are often overwhelmed not only by the concept that the answers they seek often lie within themselves, and if they would just listen to how they tell these stories of what has happened to them and what has to shift in them, what needs to heal in them so that they can continue to tell their story but tell it from a much healthier place. Okay, so it's not just, you know, being overwhelmed only by the concept that the answers that they seek often lie within, but also, you know, some people might believe that that kind of inner freedom or peace or joy or unconditional love are just simply too good to be true. You know, that those things just belong to somebody else. It's just, I'm not worthy of it. I don't have that kind of potential. But yet, the human voice has this kind of power because, as I said prior to the break, it carries with it the energy of its vibration. And as I just an example, I just toss this out, like, you know, perhaps this is why, you know, if you've ever been around people who want to hide the truth or deny the truth, have no patience when somebody says, yeah, but what about this? Or they present the truth, or at least coming from a different perspective, it's as if the other person cannot tolerate that truth. Like, it's just, it's so unbearable to them. And here's a good example of what I mean. One of the major psychosocial spiritual obstacles, shall we say, that I run into when counseling others occurs when emotionally or even psychologically wounded people are genuinely frightened and immobilized by their potential for healing and inner growth. Because, you know, it might come as a shock, but failure is not the only thing people fear. They also fear the idea of finding inner peace and freedom. And that can also be immobilizing depending upon the person. Okay. And I remember working with a woman whose husband died after like 40 years of marriage. And yeah, she was truly grief stricken, just filled with depression, just fresh into her grief process, her mourning process, and just clearly struggling with other areas in her life. Just, you know, her life partner was gone. And apparently he did a lot of things around the house. He made the decisions, paid the bills and so forth. And she just felt like it was all starting to fall on her. And as we continued to work together, the more of her story of pain and loss started to come out. This wasn't the only significant loss in her life. She had had several, but her reaction was the same. She just didn't know what to do. She was just immobilized. Okay. But as we continued working together, there was one time I remember, as we were talking, she started to get a glimpse of, let's say, a happier life. And she immediately said to me, you know what, I can't do this anymore. I just cannot meet with you anymore. We have to stop. I don't want you to take away my grief. And, you know, be quite honest, I knew where a statement like that was coming from, and not that I could ever take away something that another person wasn't ready to let go of. But she would rather live in her grief and pain and sorrow than embrace the possibility or even responsibility that she could live a life, all the while being able to hold on to the wonderful memories of her husband. I mean, in her mind, if she let go of her grief, she had nothing else better to take on. And as a result, her story remained the same, and so did her voice, and so did her energy. Because nothing was moving, nothing was healing. Well, indeed, this is true for us. You know, even to ask ourselves this question, you know, what has so wounded us and allowed us to continuously act out of our woundedness in relationships, and yet we expect things to go differently? We wonder why we don't heal. Or why do we keep making the same mistakes? It's like because the story has not changed, because the healing has not occurred. I remember watching a debate one time, not live, but I caught this on YouTube. It was a debate with William F. Buckley and James Baldwin, who's a writer, playwright, poet, activist, and it was being held at Cambridge University. And I listened to both sides of this debate. It was just talking about the American dream at the expense of the American Negro. That was the title of the debate. And when James Baldwin got up to speak, he launches into this story about why people are the way they are. I mean, it's very profound because nobody really looked at issues. I mean, and we're going back into the 60s here now, but nobody really started to ask those kinds of questions of themselves or others, okay? And so this is just a little bit of what he shared. He said, Sheriff Clark in Selma, Alabama, cannot be dismissed as a total monster. I'm sure he loves his wife and children. He likes to get drunk. And one has to assume that he is a man like me, but he does not know what drives him to use the club or to menace with the gun or to use the cattle prod. Something awful must have happened to him and happened to him as a human being to be able to put a cattle prod against a woman's breast. I mean, after all, what happens to the woman is ghastly. But what happens to the man who does this is in some ways much, much worse. I mean, those are powerful words coming from James Baldwin, because as I said, he flips the whole debate on its head and says, you know, where are these issues really coming from? What's happened in another person's life that shape how they are, you know, in their present relationships? And so what James Baldwin is reminding us here through this, you know, through this debate with William F. Buckley was that the offender and the oppressor, they suffer from a greater tragedy of inner pain, emotional pain, than perhaps the one who suffers externally or outwardly. I mean, pain is pain, but when you think about what drives people or what has brought a person to be able to hurt another and walk away, or to allow their head to hit the pillow at night and just drift off to sleep as if nothing was wrong. What's happened in their life that has so desensitized them to not being able to feel what they just did to somebody else? And this is a phenomena that, I mean, ironically, I run into time and again counseling clients who want to heal from their past and improve their relationships. You know, whatever a person is struggling with from other relationships, more than, you know, likely is struggling with the same issues in themselves. You know, what negative energy is being sent out through our words or our actions echoes back sooner or later. Okay, and this is how I kind of explain, you know, reaping what you sow, or the idea of karma to kids. You know, it's like we live in an echo. You know, we live in this, you know, enormous echo, like being in a gigantic cave, and we shout and we send our voices out, but sooner or later, our voice is going to come back to us. So what we put out there echoes back to us. However, we change the voice, we change the vibration, we change the energy. And I propose that understanding, you know, what I would call self-inflicted wounds are like the vibration of this echo, you know, that the negative energy of what we send out through our thoughts, our words, our actions is going to return to us, just like when we hear the sound of our voice echoing back in our ears when we're in a tunnel or, let's say, cave. And this energy, and unless we transform this energy, you know, through healing our own words, it's going to come back to us exactly how it went out from us. As we all explore, you know, our painful memories and the stories that we are so familiar with, we often get a glimpse of what healing and wholeness just might look for us. Okay, and that's actually a very good thing. You know, we have to see the potential for change in ourselves. We have to see the potential for healing and wholeness. And just what then does that place on us in terms of responsibility? What direction is this going to take our lives, and so forth? Okay, and whenever this insight occurs, you know, we might be tempted to resist that change, or even run away from transformation, or even sabotage ourselves by falling back into the old ways in order to avoid embracing what, let's say, a thorough healing requires of us. You know, like perhaps an acknowledging of a wrongdoing, or asking for and receiving forgiveness, or letting go of bitterness, letting go of resentment, or taking responsibility and living in gratitude, or and so forth. Okay. Well, there's a great book not if you don't have anything else to read on your nightstand table, like I do. I always have 5 books going at once. But a great book to read this winter, or even have to check it out and see if it's on Audible. But anyway, a great book is The Wounded Healer by Henry Nouwen. And in it, Nouwen states that about 74% of people who feel compelled to go into helping relationships or helping professionals or first responders do so because they understand themselves as being wounded. I mean, they can identify with, you know, another person, another wounded person, because they see themselves as wounded, and this motivates them to alleviate not only the other person's suffering or pain, but perhaps in a kind of serendipitous way to alleviate the pain and suffering of their own. Okay. Now, I'll take this one step further and say that people not only see themselves as wounded, but they also know the power of this kind of a transformative healing that takes place in themselves, and they also know its effect on the rest of humanity. You know, that perhaps if they can help somebody heal, they can help heal themselves, or vice versa, and it makes the world a better place to live. Okay. Well, admittedly, looking to others for this kind of approval and self-worth appears to be, you know, part of this natural part of developing a sense of who we are. You know, this behavior is often how we first learn about ourselves or others or the world. And, you know, it's just interesting you talk about stories, but families and teachers or other early childhood authority figures kind of reflect their own views and mirror these perceptions back to us. And oftentimes this is done through stories, okay? But not always, okay? And here's a good example. Long before we could even form words, okay, we're taking in language because it's what we're listening to. We are skilled at reading facial prompts or sensing another person's approval or disapproval or recognizing tones of, let's say, love or laughter or anger and contempt or distinguishing between a loving touch or a cold detachment and learning every other emotion in between. Like I said, this all occurs in our brains even before we start to, you know, babble a few words ourselves. And our sense of touch is just highly, highly sensitized. And this, you know, is why, you know, don't take offense to this, but this is why, let's say, if a baby doesn't want to go to you because you'd like want to hold the baby and kiss the baby, love the baby, you know, the baby's like, not having anything of it. Don't take it personally, okay? Some kids just go to, you know, some people and not others. But we are so sensitized to how we are being held or how we're being touched or not. Okay, but sometime around 3 months of age, you know, we begin to engage in this kind of a face-to-face interaction with our caregivers. And this is where, you know, or how early emotional development is also occurring in us. And we are listening to stories. We're listening to, let's say, the stories of the family. We are listening to how stories are being told, what stories are being read to us, or what stories, you know, we're listening to at night before bedtime or something like that. And as infants, we display this kind of visual, facial, and vocal behaviors later on in response to how we're being treated, you know, through a kind of a, I would say, like a give and take exchange between ourselves and others. And this typically helps us understand different situations. And we just, you know, take it for granted because we grow up with the understanding of like, okay, this is a cultural norm. This is how you're supposed to behave in certain contexts. Okay. And, you know, as a result, we hold these initial interactions within our bodies, our physical self, as we developed a sense of trust and safety. Or let's say we go the other way and we develop a sense of suspicion or distrust. And from these early stages of infancy and as we grow, we learn to regulate our emotions as we are taking our social cues from the people around us. You know, how to express our feelings appropriately or when and where such emotions are to be displayed properly. You know, we quickly distinguish between, you know, okay, we're at, you know, a parent's work or we're playing or let's say we're at school or we're around family celebrations or we're attending a funeral and so forth. And as we physically and emotionally mature, we have to learn to become less dependent on others for this directional affirmation, and we replace it with an internalized or individualized sense of who we are. In other words, instead of looking externally to get what we need in terms of approval and or acceptance, we now look within to find such qualities, such as resiliency and peace and self-love. And ironically, these initial impressions come to us by the stories in which we hear. And as we get older, we just might be tempted to parrot those same stories and just spit them out the same way they were told to us. And so it is my hope and it is my trust that the year 2021 will be filled with stories and tell each other stories, but listen to yourself and how you tell stories. And do you tell these stories from a place of woundedness filled with pain and negative emotions, or are your stories being told from a healthier place of healing and wholeness? Well, I'm Dr. James Houck, and you've been listening to Reclaiming Authenticity. Again, Happy New Year. Celebrate it however you would like to celebrate it. And keep in mind that our stories are all around us. So until next week, I ask that you would take care, be safe, behave yourselves, and God bless.
For an answer, or just to leave 1,000 comments, or prodding to buy a book by Dr. Houck, it's all there. Just wander on over to ReclaimingAuthenticity.com and click around. And we'll see you next Friday at noon Pacific Time on PBS Radio TV.